Well, welcome to another episode of Fucan Conversation. I am so excited and honored to have our guest on this show for this episode, Cindy Blackstock, who's a member of the Gitxsan First Nation. She's served as the executive director of the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society and is a professor at McGill's University of School of Social Work. She has over 30 years of experience working in child welfare and Indigenous children's rights and has published more than 75 articles on topics relating to reconciliation, Indigenous theory, First Nations child welfare, and human rights. Cindy was honored to work with First Nation colleagues on a successful human rights challenge to Canada's inequitable provision of child and family services and failure to implement Jordan's principle. This hard-fought litigation, as we will discuss today, has resulted in hundreds of thousands of services being provided to First Nation children, youth, and families. So without further ado, Cindy, how are you doing? I'm so thankful to have you on a Fucan Conversation today.
Well, thanks, Nick. I got Spirit Bear here. So, you know, I always have him close by to give me a little prod when I start to feel tired or whatever. And I'm doing really well, thanks. I feel really blessed to be seeing so many caring Canadians really voicing their support for residential school survivors, but also to ensure that there's justice for this generation of children and those who follow. So all that's good. I really need a haircut though, Nick. So I'm really hoping for this lockdown to end sooner than later.
I was the same. I got so frustrated last weekend because I asked Lori if she would cut my hair. And she's like, Nick, I am too tired to cut your hair right now. I'll do it tomorrow. And I'm like, I can't wait. So I went out in the backyard with my phone. And she said it was such a hilarious scene. She could see me with scissors just yanking and cutting. And then I tried with the clippers. And I came in and she's like, that's not bad for how it looked from out here. And then she helped clean it up the next day. So I can empathize. She's been looking, she hasn't had her haircut since the start of the pandemic.
Whoa. I know, we're all looking like the Shaggy PAs here in Ontario.
So how have you and Spirit Bear, what have you been doing since the start of the pandemic?
Well, you know what? We have an amazing team at the Caring Society, and we really pivoted to try and make resources, learning resources available online to support teachers, to support parents, and to support children. So that was, we have this whole campaign called Hibernating for Health, where we have learning resources for children of all ages, for young people and post-secondary as well, to learn about the link between the historical injustices like residential schools to the contemporary ones, and then how we can involve ourselves in addressing those contemporary injustices based on that learning. So there's been a lot of that. And otherwise, I went from traveling 200 days a year down to zero. So I have done, you know, I know every inch of this house now, and I can't wait to get back out in the road and go see communities and do all that stuff again.
And so how has it been shifting to whether it's WebEx or Zoom or I don't even know in terms of it, McGill University, if you're all using Microsoft Teams, but how has that been in terms of trying to navigate meeting with communities or the different organizations that you would visit with internationally or even your work at the university?
Yeah, well, you know what? Just my personality is I'm a social butterfly and I also love food. Which makes food and people go together. So I'm not a huge fan of Zoom. I think it really just, it was a necessary tool during the pandemic and I was glad that it was there. But I will not be relying on this once the all clear sign is put up by public health.
Yeah, and so at McGill University, did that impact you as well? Because I know that you teach a course there. And so one, did you happen to teach that course this year? And was that the case that you were for maybe the first time online with your students together?
Yeah, so I had to teach two courses this year. I teach the First Peoples course, which is the mandatory course for social workers. And then I teach a graduate level course on advocacy for social work and law students. Both of them I had to do by Zoom this year. Yeah, we made it through. I mean, three cheers for the students. They kind of put up with me. But I really think that the technology that McGill has is quite frankly, from the dark ages. So if they're going to continue online learning, I'm hoping that they go to an actual online learning platform, because I've taught online before and I've also learned online, but we had software that was designed for that. And that just makes a whole big difference.
Well, here at the University of Ottawa, we use Brightspace. So I don't know if they asked you to just, you know, do it through Google or try to do through something through Zoom or you were to figure it out on your own. I'm not quite sure.
Zoom and My Courses, which is a platform for to subsidize in-person learning. Those were the tools we had. So,
and the kind of work that you do with students there in terms of the courses and then the connections to the work that you're doing with the First Nations Caring Society. I did get a chance to read a bit of your work, and I'm trying to get a sense of what you've been speaking to over the past 2 weeks in terms of the knowledge that came out in relation to the devastating news. And when I say news, it's not news for a lot of different communities, but more confirmation of the 215 kids at the Kamloops Residential School. And you wrote a piece called "The Occasional Evil of Angels: Learning from the Experiences of Aboriginal Peoples and Social Work." And I'm wondering, in light of what has been confirmed, and in terms of, you know, in the media and even this morning on CBC talking about social work as a sector, how have you been thinking that through in relation to the work that you do with students or just in terms of advocacy with the public?
Right. So one of the things that I think that we have in academia collectively is a convenient amnesia that allows ourselves, particularly in professions like mine, and also I would argue in education, to kind of proclaim some benevolence, to say that, you know, we were trying to do the right thing, but we just didn't know back then. When you really turn back the pages of history, the truth looks quite a bit different than that. The truth is that we did know, or we ought to have known. And we chose to be willfully blind and morally cowardice in the face of needing to take action. And in many ways, we were complicit in the system. We were assisting in the system. And some people think, well, we didn't think about it back then. But that's not what I'm seeing in the documents. What I'm seeing is there is a lot of careful thought by social workers, for example, in the 1940s, who the National Association carefully looked at the Indian Act, prepared a submission, supports residential schools continuing on, does acknowledge inequalities in public services for, quote, Indian children, but doesn't do anything more than just put that in a submission. And so in my profession, one of the things I'm really concerned about is that we really position ourselves as social justice. But when the chips are down, Nick, and it's systemic discrimination that's at stake, social work just hasn't shown up. And we need to do a much better job of addressing the systemic discrimination that too often is codified at the level of the child or the family as a personal deficit. Like a child, for example, who maybe has a learning disability, but no one accounts for the fact that that child's in a First Nation school that's receiving far less funding than other schools, or a First Nations kid who ends up in foster care, but no one accounts for the fact of the multi-generational trauma and the deficits in federal government services on reserve to deal with that trauma, that kind of thing.
Again, I mean, that we're not aware of in terms of the collaborations, it's almost in silos in terms of in the educational sector or in terms of the work that you do in social work, having those kind of conversations to think about how as teachers, and I think it's a lot to put again on teachers' shoulders, but it's so important when we're thinking about teacher education about being trauma-informed in relation to how one might, for example, teach about the intergenerational harms of the interresidential schooling system, but then also try to, connect it to the contemporary context in terms of what we see. And again, this morning on my way in, I was listening to CBC, and the discussion about how once the Indian residential schooling system was closed in 1996, or the last school to be closed in 1996, that there was an increase in the amount of kids that were then put into care. And I'm just wondering, how have you been having those conversations with either your students or doing work in relation to the Caring Society to address that, the continuation although in different context in terms of that?
Yeah, it's a really good question, Nick. And what a lot of folks don't understand is there's more kids in state care than there was at the height of residential schools. One of the things that we look at are the inequities. And I really recommend to all your listeners, look at the equity research. It's the closest thing we have to a silver bullet to address a lot of the education, socioeconomic, and health disparities. The greater the inequality, the greater we hear the words overrepresentations of certain groups. So when we looked at the services on reserve and in the Yukon for First Nations kids, what we found is the federal government's funding those services, and they're underfunding all of them since Confederation. Basics like water, to child welfare, to addictions programs, to recreation programs, education, early childhood, the whole whack is all underfunded. And what that does is that piles up on the hopes and dreams of kids, and it makes it less likely that they'll be able to live the lives they wish to have, and that more likely that they're going to get into some kind of crises. And then when they do, there's fewer tools to respond to it. Meanwhile, in the non-Indigenous society, Canada was weaving this very toxic stereotype that First Nations kids got more. So these poor little kids were getting less, but being judged by a society and largely by an uninformed media as if they got more. That was the space we walked into. And originally, back in the late 1990s, after the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples was released, and that was a 20-year plan out of the Indian Act, I was thinking then, we'll sit down with the government. We'll document these inequalities in child welfare. We'll come up with a solution, and they'll do the right thing, because who wouldn't do the right thing for kids? And we did that. We found that the First Nations kids were getting 78 cents on the dollar, and many First Nations kids were being denied services because of jurisdictional buck passing from governments. Got a nice letter from the government saying they're going to review the report, and then they did nothing. They wanted a second report. So I got sucked in again. We did the second report. This one far more detailed in 2005, showing a 30% shortfall and showing how that shortfall was particularly in services to keep families together. And the government sent us another letter. They liked the report, and then they didn't do anything. And that's when we were sitting at that table, Nick, the number of First Nations kids going into care increased 70%. So this is the danger of these official procedures, right, with the government. It gives the illusion of change without actually things changing for kids. And that's why we filed that human rights complaint against Canada. And that was in 2007 with the Assembly of First Nations. And Canada took immediate action. They cut all our core funding. And so up until today, Spirit Bear and team are completely non-government funded. It was an amazing, we survived, but we did so thanks to the public. And thanks, it also, in some ways, was a gift, even though we just about went under, because it all of a sudden made it necessary for us to break patterns. And one of those patterns we had to break is working interdisciplinary, particularly with teachers, to be able to educate and learn how to educate the Canadian public and Canadian children and young people. And that's where the great relationship started to spark with Project of Heart.
And for you, I know you wrote another piece on the concept of mosquito activism. Did that emerge out of what transpired at that moment in time in relation to the government cutting funding? Or were you thinking about this beforehand in relation to the work that you were all doing? And I'm just thinking for our listeners, if you can explain a little bit about how you've conceptualized mosquito activism in relation to the work that you do.
Yeah, well, it was really born out of necessity. You know, some people think you have to have all your ducks in a line before you do one of these big legal challenges. I say that's nonsense. You'll never have your ducks in a line. There's a great poem by Patrick Overton that kind of guides my life. And it says, when you step across that place where light leads into darkness, there'll be something solid to stand on, and or you'll be taught to fly. I had no idea how to run a social movement when we filed that case, but I had enough faith that someone would be there to teach me. At least that's what I hoped. And you know what? I started just talking to people, like, how do you do this? Getting online, doing some reading. And mosquito advocacy is really born out of, you know, my First Nation tradition, where we really just learn from the animals. And the mosquito is so tiny, but it has such a big effect on everything else. And I thought, well, this is us, little teeny caring society with our spirit bear versus the largest law firm in the country, the government of Canada. And I started to think about what are free ways where we can really engage children as social justice learners and advocates in the piece. I didn't want to do this for children. I wanted to do it with children. And I wanted to be taught by children how to do advocacy. And so the mosquito advocacy framework is designed for groups that are teeny tiny, that have evidence-based solutions and are coming up against a change-resistant environment. So how do you deal with these things? What I've learned over the years is the most important thing you need to do is manage yourself. You and those in the movement are the most at risk of sinking the movement. You have to always act with integrity, with moral courage. You have to always base your movement on love. And that's what the children have taught me. And once you get that kind of stuff right, and you're really focused on doing right, not being right, so you avoid ideological kind of positions and expose yourself to all the evidence, including contrary opinion, then you can get into the strategies of doing it. And that's all laid out in that mosquito advocacy article. But it's that self-discipline. If you don't get that done right, then you're not going to be able to succeed.
Yes. So you've put that in place. And then also calling for, whether it's in the field of social work or in the field of education, again, that we need to rethink the way we're trying to establish relationships. And you did publish a piece in 2011 called The Emergence of the Breath of Life Theory. And I've seen you really embody that in terms of the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society, that we can also see it infused within everything you do. And I was just wondering if you could explain a little bit in terms of how you're situating that theory, the theory of everything.
I've always been interested in multidisciplinary. My whole academic background is multidisciplinary. I don't have two degrees in any of the same discipline. I have four academic degrees in completely different disciplines. So just by nature, I'm always looking at how to tie knowledge together. And it never really came to me until I was doing my PhD, where I tried to make these Western theories like ecological theory or critical theory or anti-oppressive practice. Those were all sold to me as being, quote, First Nations friendly ones, but they didn't fit. So I thought, this is ridiculous. Why would I use these things when I could challenge myself to think more deeply about what is the worldview I'm actually operating from? Why is it that I've got this kind of very different academic career than most people, right? All these different degrees and different universities and haven't really specialized in anything. And so I was at the University of Toronto and I was the only First Nations student in the class. And every time I would fundamentally think differently about something, I just put it in a notebook. And then I go back to elders and figure out if it was a quirky Cindyism or whether it was really something more deep in the ontology. And I also am very enthusiastic about physics. And I always looked at physics as being, you know, here you have a group of people all over the world of all diversities trying to figure out one theory that explains all matter across time. So why are we picking apart the human existence in social work? Didn't make any sense. This theory of everything, is really a reclamation of First Nations ontology. It accepts that, for example, our ancestors are mostly right versus mostly wrong. It takes very expansive concepts of time and of space. It recognizes multi-dimensions of reality. It has a series of what are called relational worldview principles, kind of like determinants of health, but it situates them so that we understand what the word balance means. And I put it out there as really an opportunity for people to kind of build on it, to say, no, that doesn't sound right. Let's put something else in there. Because there was really nothing like it back then, or at least nothing I could find. And so in my work at the Caring Society, I really take an interdisciplinary approach. Maybe it's because, you know, we got ourselves into this trouble with the government of Canada, but it just seemed to me to be the space where you welcome in all the gifts that different people in society have, educators, fine arts people, people in communications, people in statistics, researchers. We bring them all together to solve one critical question, a problem, which is what will it take for First Nations children to thrive? So that's really where I think, you know, I find my space is really sitting within that theory of everything and always trying to pull in these different connections and really resisting any kind of a segmented approach.
And I really appreciate it in the article. And as you've done elsewhere, like, for example, as you opened up to remind us that, look, if you're going to use the argument that it was just the context of the time and that's how society was, this is why certain policies in terms of justifying the extensive everyday evilness that was present within society. And you point to people like Dr. Bryce, but also even in this piece, you remind the reader that, Abraham Maslow's hierarchy, he actually spent time with the Blackfoots in Canada, is what you write in this piece, and that, you know, his interpretation actually got it wrong. And so you provide a reinterpretation through Cross's work within that piece.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is what's happened in colonialism is fundamentally a savage civilized dichotomy, where the intellect and the knowledge and the experience of indigenous peoples gets erased because it is in that savage category, which means it can only be approved upon by Western knowledge. And therefore, many of the things that we actually use as regular, shall we say, societal building blocks, like Maslow's hierarchy of needs or the system of the United Nations, where every state gets a vote, that's taken from the Iroquois Confederacy, but we just erase where it came from and kind of reclaim it within this Western space. And what I'm really encouraging people to do is to look back at the many contributions that First Nations, Métis, and Inuit peoples have. And I also, in my writings, reject the word healing. I do not like that word. I think that that reinforces that savage and civilized dichotomy. What I'd rather see is that we are building on our multi-generational strength to address the colonial challenges. But I don't want to be defined as recovering from sickness. That's not what I want to be doing with my life, or I don't want to see children having that destiny either.
And you are next week getting ready again to go back to court with the federal government in relation to Jordan Principal, Jordan River Anderson, and the Human Rights Tribunal. And you did make reference to it at the start of our conversation. But again, I'm just wondering for our listeners if you can outline kind of the timeline of what's transpired. And I know I think it's now at, 19 non-compliance orders that the federal government has refused to comply or is appealing in court.
Yeah, so this case was filed in 2007. Canada's filed 8 motions to get it dismissed. And what was so exciting, and Nick, you'll remember that because you were just a real part of this and your students were, is that we had this campaign called I Am a Witness, which invited people to read all the court documents and, if possible, to come to the hearings. And almost no one did until 2009. And when they did, it was young people. And then by 2012, there were so many children and young people and teachers in the courtroom that we booked them in shifts. So children, because they hadn't been indoctrinated with this idea that First Nations are getting more, they could see the unfairness and they wanted to do something about it. So this was the bright part of this whole hearing for me. So by 2013, we finally get to hearing because Canada lost all those efforts to toss it out on a technicality. The hearings took 2 years. Decision comes out in 2016, substantiating the discrimination, saying Canada is giving less for child welfare, particularly in the area of keeping families together, and that's contributing directly to the overrepresentation of First Nations kids in care. And also that Canada had deliberately failed, or actually chosen, to not implement Jordan's principles so First Nations kids could get the access to public services they need when they need them. Minister Bennett comes out, welcomes a decision. Then they don't do anything, and the non-compliance orders pile up. Fortunately, we have now, thanks to these non-compliance orders and the strength of Jordan River Anderson's family and everybody who's been a part of Jordan's Principle, over 800,000 services have been given out under Jordan's Principle this last couple of years. But we still have some more work to do, and the child welfare budget is doubled, but it's still not equitable. So we still have some more work to do there. Next week, though, Canada is appealing two of those orders to federal court. The first one is compensation to the children. It acknowledges it separated wrongfully from their families because of this underfunding. It hurts some children, denying them learning supports, for example, in the early years, so that their learning disability wouldn't get worse. And number three, they actually admit that their discrimination contributed to the deaths of some children. And the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal awarded $40,000 per child in compensation for those harms. Canada doesn't want to pay any of it. And so it is it's appealing that order. That'll be heard next week. And on Jordan's principle, Canada says, we don't want to provide Jordan's principle to kids off reserve unless they have Indian Act status. And yes, that's that same racist Indian Act that drove residential schools. And in fact, probably was leveraged to, remove those 215 children in Kamloops and place them in that residential school. So Canada's still leaning on that racist Indian Act to try and limit what type of services that First Nations kids will get. So that's next week. And the Prime Minister, bafflingly enough, has been maintaining all this week that he's not litigating against children. And that's completely false. Even his own legal documents show that. So yeah, it's pretty concerning that we've been 14 and a half years in this case and Canada is still fighting against First Nations kids.
Have you felt this month, because it's Indigenous History Month here in Canada, the month of June, that there's more focus or attention, say, in the schooling system, teachers taking it up, but also in the media? Have you found that the media has been reporting differently, and that teachers that are now in the school that you've been fortunate enough to work with are taking up things differently since the case started? I know that you've been on a few times to point out how the federal government's been framing and its rhetoric, but also speaking out in relation to the abstaining of the vote in the federal government, in the legislature, and also just recently in the Senate, in terms of what transpired and the calling out of a member for their cultural attire or ceremonial belongings that they bring into sessions.
Yeah, you know what? The federal government has so many lawsuits against First Nations, Métis, and Inuit people. Responding to them feels like playing a game of whack-a-mole, to be honest, Nick. Like, they're just, the largest portion of the Canadian Department of Justice's litigation budget is used to litigate against First Nations, Métis, and Inuit peoples. One of the good things about our case is at the beginning when we launched it in 2007, a lot of the stereotypes were still resonating a lot. So people thought, well, must be because the chief is getting the money and not spending it on the proper things. But then through education and awareness, the media and the public started to understand that the problem was in the House of Commons, that the federal government was really shortchanging these kids. And so we've enjoyed very good press coverage at all the major points during this case. And certainly this week, in the wake of the news of the 215 children from Kamloops, I think that the stories have finally built up on the conscience of the nation. And the public is starting to come to grips with the human dimensions of the injustices, both past and present. And they want it to stop. And that's where that motion in Parliament came from, which is a motion that was passed unanimously, although all members of the cabinet and the Prime Minister abstained, calling on them to stop this litigation against survivors, stop this litigation against kids, and get busy and do those TRC calls to action. So the public has its eyes wide open. And that's really critical, because every time the public looks away, the gut injustices for children continue. So it's absolutely essential that we force the government to change and make it clear to any elected representative that their ability to get our vote depends on them ending what is really amounts to apartheid public services for First Nations kids.
And you just said, like, the largest amount of funding provided for litigation is in relation to cases with First Nation, Métis, and Inuit communities. And I just, like, as a first generation immigrant settler to Canada, paying my taxes, like knowing that, like, it's just so frustrating. And that, and knowing that the, in the school curriculum, say, you know, when we're we're talking about math or financial literacy, that statement and actually looking at those numbers in relation to citizenship education would be, to me, a form of social justice in terms of citizenship education that I would wish that my sons were engaging at school or even in a high school accounting course to try to understand, like, where are our tax dollars going? How are they being spent? And how are they harming others?
Yeah. You know, like, one of the things that you and Lisa Howell and Sylvia and Charlene have taught me is how to thread this throughout the entire curriculum. And you're quite right. There's lots of math in this. For example, we're working with the Institute of Fiscal Studies and Democracy to cost out how much would it cost for First Nations children to thrive. And if that was a question when I was in math class in high school, I think I'd be a lot more engaged than, you know, the usual dry, here's an equation, memorize it and regurgitate it. Because what it's doing is it's putting your knowledge into an application that could actually make the world a better place. And I see educators increasingly becoming aware of those opportunities, no matter what they're teaching. And I'd love to see it becoming even more advanced, that there's more support put to that, and that there's more support for teacher mentors who have been doing this a while to support those who are just new to it.
Well, I've been so fortunate to work with you and your team at the Caring Society, and also with Lisa and Madeline, Lisa Howell and Madeline McCracken, who've been so committed to working on the Spirit Bear Berry Caring curriculum. And I'm just wondering, in terms of moving forward over the next year, so you have next week, but in terms of the work with elementary school teachers, what are you working on with the Caring Society in terms of those kind of collaboration and educational materials in relation to the campaigns that you have in place?
Yeah, well, we actually, you know, Spirit Bear is an author, Nick, as you know.
Yes.
And he has a
pretty prolific.
He is. He's taking a bit of a break this year because of the hibernating for health thing. But basically, as you know, all of his books are about telling the true story about how children of all diversities came together to deal with contemporary injustices while learning from the past. And the books are beautifully illustrated by a group called Spotted Fawn Productions out of Vancouver, an Indigenous animation studio, which means that we've put them to animation. And one of them is already telling the story about this human rights case and Jordan's principle. It's called Spirit Bear and Children Make History. So we released that animation at a drive-in, given COVID, on Orange Shirt Day last year, and have a whole pile of educational materials to go with that. But we have another one coming up that we're going to release hopefully in the fall. And that is going to be Spirit Bear Fishing for Dreams, Catching Knowledge. And it really tells the story of traditional knowledge, how that was changed in residential schools or tried to be eradicated, and then the inspiring story of Shannon Kustachin, who tried to change that and get safe and comfy schools for First Nations kids. We're going to have that animation come out. Again, there will be another round of teaching materials. And, you know, if people out there listening have used our resources and have found a way to make them even better, like I see that all the time, let us know so that we can share it with other people, because we're kind of amateurs at this in some ways. We're in this space. We're doing the best we can, but we really want to do better. So, and I know that a lot of your listeners are really gifted educators. So we're going to do that. And what else are we up to? Well, we always do information sheets. We have kids editions of a peer-reviewed journal. There's all kinds of things, and we're going to be revamping our website so it's easier to find stuff. So stay tuned for that.
Well, I'm super excited too, because we're in the midst of trying to put together Spirit Bear Virtual Professional Learning School for teachers.
Yes.
To help support them in schools as well. So it's just amazing to see how many teachers now want to do this work and want to learn and unlearn through doing the work. And that they're committed to doing that. And I just, one final question. In terms of all of the work that you've done so far, I mean, what's your sense in terms of the next generation of kids that you've been able to work with in terms of moving forward, despite all the, you know, the petitions that the federal government has in place? What's your sense and moving forward as we come out of the pandemic in light of your work with young kids?
I would say to people that really, if they don't engage children in social justice work, they're really missing an opportunity to raise a generation of children with the tools and with the knowledge to be able to confront the major challenges that we're leaving for them: climate change, dealing with diversity, all of those things. And the kids have shown me that they are capable of learning about difficult issues like residential schools, but doing more than that, taking that learning and really you applying it to make a better world for everyone. I've just learned so much from these kids, and I think that they're the best advocates. If you're just doing youth engagement, you are too late in the cycle. Start with daycare.
Well, thank you so much, Cindy, for taking the time to join us on Fukin Conversation. I continue to be inspired by the work that you do, but also through the kind of relations that you want us to think about in terms of our commitment as non-Indigenous citizens and how we need to rethink those relations and moving forward in relation to First Nation, Métis, and Inuit communities.
Hey, Nick, it was always good to spend time with you. And everybody, got to check out the good work that Nick does. And this research project we've been doing together on kind of assessing what teachers' opinions are about involving their kids in campaigns. There's lots of good and exciting stuff there. And we're going to build on those lessons to make it even better in Spirit Bears Virtual School coming out this year.